This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Someone once sent us an email asking why we sometimes allow a girl to host a sports show. Fact is, we could fill an entire year's worth of shows with stories about barriers to female participation in sports. This is one of those stories, but in this case, it's not a person or even a group of people standing in the way of women in sports. It's a body part. Our champion in this fight is, well, I'll let her tell you who she is.
I'm a human being, and I try to live life beautifully.
And how about a name and maybe a job title-ish?
Oh, I can do that.
Lisa Lindahl has run a multinational corporation. She spent 9 years on the board of the National Epilepsy Foundation. She's worked with breast cancer survivors, and she's just finished writing a book about true beauty.
And yet, what still captures the imagination is the sports bra.
Yes, the sports bra. And I'll just mention here that if you're a person who is scandalized or offended by the fact that women have breasts, this might not be the story for you.
It began when I was a little girl who liked to avoid gym class.
Lisa attended an all-girls school. It was the 1960s.
In the locker room, you had to change into these bloomers and little tunics and... And then you had to put your clothes back on, you're all sweaty, and you had the same bra on.
But later, married and living in Vermont, Lisa was swept up in the running craze of the 1970s. She finally found something worth sweating for.
Running for me became this joy. I grew up with epilepsy, and I had seizures regularly. So I was not really friendly with my body so much until I started running. But there was one problem. My breasts were just uncomfortable.
40 years ago, in the summer of 1977, Lisa got a call from her sister. She had just started running, too.
And she said, okay, so but what do you do for a bra? It's so uncomfortable. And I laughed and said, yeah, I know, it really is. You know, it's just a terrible problem. She said, you know, why isn't there a jockstrap for women? And we just laughed uproariously. We thought that was so funny. When we hung up, I thought to myself, that's not such a silly idea.
Lisa sat down and started writing a wish list.
The straps wouldn't fall. There wouldn't be any hardware to dig in. It couldn't chafe. It would be breathable and lightweight and all these wonderful things.
But there was one more feature that Lisa had on her mind. See, her regular running partner was a guy.
And he would take off his shirt when we were running through the Vermont summer woods and tuck it in the back of his shorts. And I was always so jealous. Part of me wanted this new bra that somehow it would be modest enough for me to be able to do that. And I didn't really think it would be possible, but I hoped so.
Luckily, an old friend from that all-girls school, Polly Smith, was renting a room from Lisa and her husband while she worked on costumes for the Royal Tyler Theater in Burlington.
So I went upstairs and I said, Polly, help me make this thing. She rolled her eyes.
Polly knew something Lisa didn't. Unlike other clothes, bras needed to be engineered.
We would go up to the costume shop and she would cut and sew something and I'd go out running in it. And those early prototypes just were not cutting it.
One day, Polly and Lisa were sitting together on the living room floor when Lisa's husband came walking down the stairs with his jock strap pulled over his chest.
Saying, you know, hey ladies, here's your jock bra, ha ha ha. So I took it off of him and pulled it down over my own chest because I had to be part of the funny, ha ha ha. And the minute I did it, I looked at Polly and I said, you know what? This has potential.
The next day, Polly took two jock straps and cut them apart. The cups became, well, cups. The leg straps were crossed over the back to become shoulder straps. The waistband became a rib band. It was the first modern sports bra.
And when I went running in that, it worked. So we deconstructed the jock strap and recreated it as a jock bra.
Polly took a trip to New York City to find nicer fabric and elastic, and Lisa found a business partner to help fund the endeavor. Lisa's idea was working, but her marriage was not, and that presented its own problems.
I had been brought up to believe that I could not live alone, that if I were ever to have a seizure alone, I could die. And so here I was getting a divorce and facing living alone. I was in my late 20s. When I started, I didn't even have a driver's license. I had to go cry at my neurologist and get a driver's license. When you ask me how all that was, it was frightening.
Lisa decided the only thing to do was to keep moving forward. One of the first decisions she made about her new product, she decided to call it the Jog Bra, was that it didn't belong in department stores.
I won't say it was a feminist attitude, but maybe. That this was serious athletic equipment. This was not about lift and separate. It wasn't about looking pretty. It was about function. Someone that was looking for function would go to a sporting goods store. So here is the girl who skipped gym classes walking into sporting goods stores to sell them a bra.
And as serious athletic equipment, the jog bra wasn't meant to be pretty. It was big and white and elastic-y. Lisa had this notion that all good sporting trends start in California, so she flew to San Francisco with a little briefcase full of samples. She hopped on a city bus and started looking for potential customers.
And as the sporting goods store would go by, I'd hit the ding-ding thing and get off the bus and walk back to the sporting goods store. But anyway, when I got the right person, it was always a he, and he would say, "A bra? Why would I put a bra in my sporting goods store?" And I would look at him and I'd say, "You carry jock straps, don't you?"
The sales pitch worked. Lisa's company was profitable in its first full year and grew in double digits every year after. But it wasn't just gumption that made Lisa's business grow. Those were the early days of Title IX, a federal law that guaranteed girls and women equality in education, including sports. More women playing sports meant that more women needed sports bras. And sports bras brought women who had stopped participating back to the court's field and running paths. In 1984, a grad student named LaJean Lawson was awarded a research grant to study breast motion with a goal of learning how to build a better sports bra. A watchdog group awarded her research a Golden Fleece Award for worst misuse of state tax dollars. Then came the letters. If God had intended women to play sports, one anonymous note said, he wouldn't have put breasts on their chests. There was something deeper going on, because when Lisa Lindahl and LaJean Lawson were growing up, there was a sense that women were somehow too frail for vigorous exercise. Girls were forbidden from crossing the half-court line while playing basketball and couldn't run races longer than 400 meters. There was even literature suggesting too much exercise could damage women's breasts and that bras could cause cancer. But we can now prove that those ideas are bogus, in part because LaJean Lawson and other researchers came onto the scene to study how to build better sports bras. And while they were doing that, they also proved that sports bras aren't needed to mitigate any potential damage to women's bodies. They're just about comfort. In 1984, when Joan Benoit ran into the Los Angeles Coliseum to win the first women's marathon in Olympic history, her bra strap was showing. Some people were scandalized, but over time, opinions changed. Maybe you know where this is going.
Hello, everyone. I'm Robin Roberts, and this is what they are playing for, the Women's World Cup trophy.
In 1999, the U.S. played China in the Women's World Cup in front of a sold-out crowd at the Rose Bowl. The teams played to a tie. Brandi Chastain took the last penalty kick.
Go!
By that time, Lisa Lindahl had sold her company. It became Champion. But when Brandi Chastain ripped off her jersey, just like the men often do, and swung it around in triumph, Lisa was watching.
It was a wish and a hope and a desire, and there it was, right on not just national TV, it was international. There are people all over the globe watching that.
Yeah, what was that moment? Because to me, that's when I saw that and I was just like, wow. Not only is it okay that she's ripped off her shirt like the guys do, but it's okay that she has muscles. It's okay that she's strong. It's okay. So many things are okay here.
Exactly. Exactly. When she's asked about that moment, she talks about it being a long journey, you know, a long accumulation of effort and work. And that's what my life has been. It's like the two of us coming from two very different places. It all sort of came together in that moment of woman's power and glory and truthfulness. And that was a moment of true beauty, oh, by the way. Thank you, Brandy.
What's interesting is that just as the sports bra changed sports culture has come back to change the sports bra. Women don't have to fight for their right to participate anymore. Nobody has to convince stores to carry sports bras. And sports bras no longer have to be these ugly, utilitarian, functional things. Women today can choose to be strong and beautiful.
I mean, it gives me such a kick to walk into a department store and see a whole wall of sports bras, all different colors. Some of them are very lacy. It's just amazing. And I think, oh, I mean, who would have thunk it?
It took both Title IX and the invention of the sports bra to make it possible for all women to participate in sports, which wasn't the goal of that newly divorced woman from Vermont who was just trying to figure out how to pay the bills.
I never approached it with the idea of making the world a better place. So what do I feel? I feel humbled and amazed and proud. And amazed.
It might be a stretch to say that without the sports bra allowing more women to participate in sports, women might not have been hired as sports journalists, and I might never have gotten the chance to sit in Bill Littlefield's chair while he's away. But maybe. So thanks, Lisa. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first, Billy from Germantown left us the following review on iTunes. Bill Littlefield is a great writer and an engaging radio voice. The weekly hour goes by so quickly. My favorite podcast. Thanks, Billy from Germantown. If Bill Littlefield was here, he'd thank you too. If you have a moment, please consider leaving a review of your own wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help other listeners find our show. NBA fans can stop frantically refreshing Twitter, or at least they can give their thumbs a bit of a rest, because the NBA trade deadline has come and gone. That's up first on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Hello to both of you.
Hey, Karen.
Hello.
Mike, first of all, how's your thumb? And second, tell us your takeaway from the latest round of trades.
I guess my thumb is up if you're the New Orleans Pelicans, because they certainly ripped off a Sacramento Kings team who traded one of the finest basketball players, DeMarcus Boogie Cousins, who is like the 6'10 version of Shaquille O'Neal. Trades are interesting, and I like the remaking of the NBA season, which is entirely too long. But this is why it's interesting. To the entire NBA, like a lot of sports, what has changed so much in the last, say, 15 years is geography, the spacing on the court. And it's more of a subtle thing. If you only watch the ball, you might not notice this. But just as in baseball, the shift has been embraced, and just as in football, they now spread the offense wide. In basketball, it's all about huge gaps between players, and this allows guys like Steph Curry to nail threes willy-nilly. The Pelicans have gone another way, maybe out of design. Maybe it's just because they already have Anthony Davis, this great center. They got Boogie Cousins, and now they're going to have a throwback to the days of Twin Towers or guys who will need the ball down low. And I like the lanyap, as a New Orleanian might say, of this little bit of difference that the current breed of Pelicans brings. Also, I just love talking about Pelicans in a sports context.
This is fantastic for fans like me who love the grinded out era of the 90s, the Knicks, the Bulls, the Pistons. I still have a Bill Laimbeer jersey in my closet. But is there going to be any chemistry between these two players? That's the question that's really going to be interesting to watch and follow.
Yeah, after the first game, that certainly is a question. I mean, they lost 129-99 to the Houston Rockets. Not a good start, but also not a reason to panic. It feels like these guys are probably still introducing themselves to each other. Mike, what I'm wondering is, wasn't this maybe somehow inevitable? I mean, there are a lot of teams now with a bunch of smaller guys who shoot threes, so a bunch of smaller guys who shoot threes are now off the market and hard to find, and these bigger guys are a little bit of a better deal. I mean, wasn't someone going to jump on this eventually?
I don't know if this is a case where there is a total trend, spacing, small guys, threes. So the smart thing is to run counter to that trend, to hedge. Or if they have shown the way to play basketball and hedging is just, you know, hearkening back to the past. I kind of think of it this way. The Army War College studies Hannibal, and yet it's still not a good idea to bring elephants into battle, right? So you maybe learn the lesson, but you don't employ every tactic.
All right, it's my turn. And on Wednesday, Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback Jameis Winston made what he calls a poor word choice when talking to third through fifth graders at Melrose Elementary School in St. Petersburg, Florida. You might remember Jameis Winston from those rape allegations at Florida State, or the ill-advised shouting in the cafeteria incident, or the fact that he walked out of a grocery store with crab legs that he hadn't paid for. Anyway, Jameis Winston asked the boys in his audience to stand up and be strong, and then, well, let's listen.
But the ladies, they're supposed to be silent, polite, gentle. But my man's supposed to be strong.
So I'm not at all surprised that Jameis Winston said something stupid, and this was stupid. But what surprises me is that people at an elementary school thought that it would be a good idea to have this guy come talk to young kids. I mean, am I wrong here? Don, tell me I'm not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. What he said was incredibly stupid. There's just no defending what he said. And you're right. What were they thinking at Melrose Elementary School? However, he's apologized. He spoke for 40 minutes. In the context of what he said, he was telling both the boys and the girls in that classroom, I can do anything I put my mind to, which is a great lesson for young people. And what I really loved about it is one of the young girls turned around after hearing what Jameis Winston said and told a teacher, I'm strong too. So I would like to prefer to view this, debacle as a teaching moment for these young people. I'm sure the thing that they're going to remember most about Jameis Winston's visit is the stupid thing he said. And I'm sure that's being emphasized to those young girls. And so in that way, it's maybe not the worst thing ever.
Yeah, this is certainly a misdemeanor, social offense, not a felony. I do wonder who the elementary school turned away. I hope Judy Blume wasn't holding up her hand. No, we'll go with Jameis. I always wonder about this. They have, I get a press release from some publicist every day about some backup tight end who's, cleaning up a park with kids. Like, how come the kids are always being pushed forward? Like, yeah, some random NFL player. We need to expose our children to this guy.
I know my colleagues who cover the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and who know Jameis Winston, this is not a one-off. He's in the community all the time on his days off talking to people and talking to young people. And so he is trying to put that horrible past behind him. Of course, putting his foot in his mouth is the worst way to do it.
I would also say the message in the NFL is to say things like this, not for elementary school kids, but to talk to men and to tell them things like, women are out to get your money, or women are out to trick you. All his life, he's gotten messages like this about powerful masculinity and kind of lived in an unfeminized world. And that might be one of the reasons he said this.
All right, Don, once again, we have saved our very most important story for last. Go ahead.
Well, as most of the sports world now knows, Wayne Shaw was the backup goalkeeper for Sutton United, a fifth-tier British soccer team that played mighty Arsenal in an FA Cup match last Monday night. Shaw is also 46 years old and weighs 320 pounds. And in the match's 83rd minute, with Arsenal safely ahead 2-0, Shaw, known as the roly-poly goalie, munched lovingly on a meat and potato pie. The video instantly went viral, and Shaw has become a national celebrity, even a hero. Well, He was for about 24 hours. By the afternoon following that match, Shaw was out of a job. It turns out the team's sponsor for the match, Sun Bets, had offered an 8-to-1 novelty wager on whether Shaw would eat a pie live on TV. And Shaw made no secret of the fact he'd been aware of the bet and that a few of his mates, though not his teammates, might have even wagered on him and the pie. For its part, Sun Bets officials have announced that they paid out a 5-figure sum on the bet. Now, it's hard not to laugh about all of this, and not surprisingly, social media has feasted on the story. But the FA and the UK's gambling commissioner are now investigating. The gambling commission's enforcement and intelligence director said integrity in sport is not a joke. So here's the question, guys. Is Wayne Shaw a villain or a hero?
Hero. Near, far. Wherever you are, I believe my pie will get eaten. If the soccer officials, can I say soccer, not football?
You can.
If the league is so invested in being cleaner than Caesar's wife, then why are they accepting the sponsorships of these gambling houses? We're talking about eating a pie. And I don't know about the compensation of the backup keeper on this one specific team, but it seemed like whatever money you could get for eating a pie might be a very large percentage of his overall compensation.
Yeah, I'm fully in the hero camp, too. Pies are delicious, even meat pies, mm-hmm. and I am pro meat pie. But I think the villain here is the establishment that offered this particular prop bet. I mean, this is ridiculous because it's almost impossible not to fix. I mean, the guy was hungry, and if he doesn't eat a meat pie, he's fixing the bet. And if he does eat a meat pie, he's fixing the bet. There's no way he can win.
That's right, and that's why he lost his job. He lost his job because the appearances were bad for the management and the owners of this particular football club. Again, a fifth-tier team. You know, what's sad about it, I agree with you guys. He's a hero, he's a legend, and he's beloved all over the UK. What's sad, though, is he has lost his job. He's a backup goalkeeper, but he really was an assistant coach. And he's a guy that did a lot of scut work around this little-known team. He finally gets his 15 minutes of fame, and then this happens to him. And he's, you know, been treated pretty shabbily. It's a sort of dark moment of a great story of Sutton United going up against Arsenal.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
Welcome.
Thanks, Karen.
The late Dean Smith took over as head basketball coach at the University of North Carolina in 1961, and pretty quickly he set upon a mission. He wanted to integrate his basketball program and, by extension, the ACC. Many people know the story of Charles Scott, the man who became the first black scholarship player at UNC in 1966. But by then, the conference had already been integrated. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the rarely told story of the man who could have been the first black varsity player at UNC and in the ACC, but wasn't.
It took a bit of convincing to get 71-year-old Willie Cooper to talk candidly about what might have been.
This is an emotional thing for me. You know, it's hard to go back into it without remembering, you know, it's not the dream. So it has haunted me all this time.
Willie Cooper was the son of poor sharecroppers in Wilson, North Carolina. He had to come a long way from that world to have any kind of dream at all.
My biological father died when I was 8 years old. And we eventually ended up on welfare. And my mother, she could not take care of us. I basically ran wild. I was in the streets in the mornings, trying to find food, foraging for myself.
Cooper says he only went to school when he wanted to. And he rarely wanted to because his classmates made fun of his Salvation Army wardrobe. He got into fights. He barely showed up for fourth grade and was going to be held back a year. Cooper's mother was diagnosed with a nervous system disorder. But then Human Services found Cooper a foster home in nearby Elm City.
They were the Mitchells. And there was one sister who was a teacher at the school that I was at. And she kind of took me under her wing, kind of forced me to read books, things like Moby Dick and Anne Frank story and a lot of things to kind of stretch my mind. And since somebody was taking an interest in me, which had never happened before, I just started blossoming. They helped me round the edges, rough edges off of me. It wasn't like I was a foster child. And there I was, 11 years old. And that summer, on my birthday, they bought me a Swin bicycle. Brand spanking.
Willie Cooper began to excel at school and in basketball.
I picked up basketball probably around the sixth grade. It appeared that I was going to be fairly tall. In the seventh grade, I made the team. That was an exciting thing to happen, to get a uniform and to be part of something, you know, a team.
He went on to star on the basketball team at Frederick Douglass High, where the 6'2 forward's defensive abilities attracted the attention of future Hall of Fame head coach Dean Smith, who at that time was struggling with a losing program at the University of North Carolina.
One day at one of the games, some white guys showed up at my high school with a Super 8 movie camera, and they were interested in finding some black players that could get into UNC because they wanted to break the color barrier there. They said that Dean Smith was interested in guys that could play and could do the schoolwork, and he sent them down to take a look at me.
Cooper had good grades, and he was admitted to UNC's School of Business in 1964 on an academic scholarship. But his basketball skills weren't enough to get him onto the varsity team and earn him an athletic scholarship and a place in history as UNC's and the ACC's first black scholarship athlete. He walked onto the freshman team, then coached by Dean Smith's assistant, Ken Rosemond.
I played well. You know, I was a very good defensive player. And the studies went well. My freshman year, I had a pretty good average.
Smith and others had been working for years behind the scenes in Chapel Hill to integrate UNC's varsity team. In 1963, Smith thought he had the right man when he recruited Lou Hudson. But Hudson couldn't pass UNC's rigorous entrance exams. Cooper wouldn't be the guy either. The official story, when anyone bothers to tell it, has a meeting with Dean Smith sometime before the summer of 1965. Smith tells Cooper that he'd like him to try out for varsity. Cooper tells Smith that he got a D on a crucial accounting exam and that he'd be dropping basketball because it had distracted him from his studies. But when you press Cooper, it becomes clear that's not the whole story. It began with his dorm assignment that first year.
They put me in a room with three football players, white guys, and they were none too happy. And so they went to Dean. Somebody went to Dean. In my mind, I got the message. And so I moved out.
And then there were the away games, where the fans and the restaurants and the hotels were anything but accommodating.
You know, I was 19 years old at this time. And I had struggled through freshman year with them not taking me to South Carolina when the team went to South Carolina. And then when we went to Virginia, I was refused service. I wanted more than anything else to play basketball.
Willie Cooper graduated from UNC in 1968 with a degree in business administration. He served in Vietnam, earning the rank of captain, before going on to a 20-year career with IBM. He started a successful lawn service company in Chattanooga, where he now lives. But he says he struggles when he thinks of the missed chance to keep playing basketball and to maybe, just maybe, make history.
I have to reach in here and there to find things that were positive for me. The fans loved me at Carolina, that I had the fortitude to stick it out, that I got a good college education. You know, these are the kinds of things that I think about, because otherwise these negative thoughts would overcome me.
But that's not the end of Willie Cooper's UNC story. That's because Cooper's son and daughter played basketball for his alma mater.
Oh, yes. Now, that's a great story, because my son, Brent, he played freshman ball. Tanya was a varsity player. In effect, I lived out my dream through her. when I got to see her on the varsity wearing that blue and white, it would bring me to tears because the women played at the same gym that I played in when I was there.
Cooper also chokes up when he talks about the national title Tanya helped the UNC women's team win in 1994 and about her graduation from UNC with a master's degree in social work. A lot has changed since that family in Elm City, North Carolina, took in a troubled 10-year-old, showed him love, and gave him a chance to succeed.
If you look back, I'm probably the most unlikely person to have gone through what I did. And I think my story is not so much the Carolina thing, but the Mitchell family that took me in.
That's Willie Cooper speaking with Only a Game's Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about the integration of UNC and the ACC, check out Art Chansky's book, Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the Era That Transformed a Southern College Town, and J. Samuel Walker's book, ACC Basketball. In the 1920s, Violette Morris became one of France's first star female athletes. Then everything went horribly wrong.
There is very definitely an accusation that she became a Nazi torturer.
Just ahead, the story of a pioneering athlete turned Nazi agent. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Bill Littlefield returns with the story of a women's college basketball team a few decades ahead of its time. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
In what clearly is the most important story of the week, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady has shared the suspect board he's using to hunt down his stolen Super Bowl jersey. So who do you think did it, Lady Gaga or the crab people from South Park?
No, my money's on Creepy Me, which is the artist rendition of Tom in the courtroom while the court was hearing his case during Deflategate. I suspect Creepy Me, but who knew that Tom Brady knew who Gollum was and all these other pop culture characters?
Well, at least his Instagram people know who those people are.
Yeah.
Okay, in real sports news, the NBA trade deadline passed this week, and we should talk about the really big deals, or maybe it would be more appropriate to talk about the deals that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest deal, obviously, was DeMarcus Cousins going to the Pelicans to pair up with Anthony Davis. Once again, though, the Boston Celtics seemed to have more chips than anybody else, didn't use any of them. Same thing can be said for Indiana. They were talking about dealing Paul George, and he's still there.
This week, L.A. Lakers team president and co-owner Jeannie Buss announced some big changes meant to get that team off the bottom of the NBA standings. I can't decide which is the bolder move, hiring Magic Johnson as the team's GM or firing her own brother Jim from his role as executive VP for basketball operations.
Well, the Busses have always been quite an interesting family, and that's only a twist in that. The interesting thing about hiring Magic is, if you remember, way back in the day, the best thing the Lakers ever did and the move that created the Lakers of the 1980s was hiring Pat Riley. And they didn't hire him from another team. They hired him out of the broadcast booth. So the Lakers are known for this kind of thing. And the last time they did it, it worked really well.
Cleveland Cavaliers point guard Kyrie Irving has said that he believes the earth is flat. And my favorite response comes from Golden State's Draymond Green, he of the multiple groin punches, who says, quote, "It's just his opinion. It's hard to call someone's opinions crazy." You have strong feelings about the difference between fact and opinion, so I'm going to let you take it from there.
First of all, I don't think Kyrie Irving was serious. I think Kyrie Irving was having a little fun. Either that or he didn't learn anything while he was in the 25 minutes he was at Duke. But yeah, you can call somebody's opinion crazy, and that opinion is crazy.
Charlie, I usually avoid talking about conference restructuring, but since breaking off from football schools and rebuilding itself as a basketball-centric conference, the Big East has had great success on the court and at the bank. So is there a lesson here?
The Big East has a lock on most of the schools that don't have football and play big-time basketball, certainly on the Catholic ones that do. This was a brilliant move, and it gets more brilliant almost by the day. And it is an interesting argument for the people who believe that big-time football is the anchor dragging down college athletics.
Spring training has sprung, thank goodness, which means that Alex Rodriguez is back, this time as a sort of life coach for the younger Yankees players. Do you think he has anything to teach?
Yeah, if he teaches from his own mistakes, absolutely.
Major League Baseball has approved the use of a dugout signal for intentional walks that will spare baseball fans the ponderous ritual of a pitcher throwing four consecutive high and wide pitches. Is this a good move?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good move. I think it's kind of, I don't know, you know, if you really want to speed up the game, enforce the time limit it takes on a pitcher to throw a baseball. But, I mean, yeah, this is silliness, but it does take out the one in a million chance that the pitcher will throw the intentional walk ball into the stands and be very entertaining.
Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred says that he's been met with a, quote, lack of cooperation from the Players Association over other rules changes meant to speed up the game. Given the fact that traditionalists also seem to unilaterally hate these proposals, is this a fight the commissioner can win?
No, it isn't. And it's not a fight you got to be bringing to the public either, given baseball's sorry history with its union.
Sammy Sosa was asked this week if it bothers him that despite a lack of proof, so many fans assume he took performance-enhancing drugs. And his response was to compare himself to Jesus Christ. Bad move?
Always a bad move. Don't compare yourself to Jesus. Even if you're Jesus, don't compare yourself to Jesus. Unless you're one of the Alou brothers, of course. Then you can compare yourself to Jesus.
Budapest has joined Hamburg and Rome in dropping out of the bidding for the 2024 Summer Olympics. Only L.A. and Paris remain in the mix. How soon before they both drop out?
I have a horrible feeling it's going to wind up in L.A. again. And I experienced the 1984 Summer Olympics in L.A. up close and personal, and I never want to go through that again.
And finally, Charlie, sports talk radio host Mike Francesa is leaving his post at WFAN in December. This week, he asked New Jersey Governor Chris Christie if he'd be interested in the job. Governor Christie didn't exactly say no, and I think this is a great idea.
Yeah, he needs a gig very badly. So, sure, why not? Let him be a talk show host for a while. Of course, he doesn't take people disagreeing with him very well.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Bill Littlefield is fond of saying that people are complicated. Our next story is about a woman who really proves that point. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Violette Morris had already been dressing like a man for years when Hitler invited her to Berlin to watch the 1936 Olympics.
It's said that she was, of course, an honored guest.
That's historian and author Anne Seba. She has researched the life of Violette Morris, a lesbian from France who is known to frequent Parisian nightclubs in the early 30s dressed in a suit and tie.
And she's made a fuss of in Germany. The Germans think she's wonderful.
Yes, Nazi officials in 1936 thought a cross-dressing lesbian from France was wonderful. It's one odd twist in the story of a pioneering athlete who's now remembered as both a feminist and a Gestapo agent. But let's start at the beginning. Long before Violette was tied to the Nazis, she was known for something quite basic: her physical size.
She was described as a colossus.
Her biceps had a circumference of nearly 14 inches, about the size of an average woman's neck.
But she was only 5'5", so a pretty sturdy hunk of woman and very, very strong.
Born in France in 1893, Violette was a natural athlete. As a girl, she excelled at boxing, javelin, shot put, and swimming.
She apparently coined the motto as a schoolgirl, "Anything a man can do, Violette can do too."
In 1914, at the age of 20, she married a man named Cyprien Gouraud. The marriage was probably arranged. Soon after, World War I began, and Cyprien went to fight. Violette's boxing gym was transformed into a Red Cross center. She signed on to become an ambulance driver and courier. And she became valuable to the French cause, serving at the battles of Verdun and the Somme.
It was really driving over rough and dangerous terrain,
past the trenches, collecting stretchers of bloody soldiers. And it was absolutely critical to get these seriously wounded French soldiers to hospital fast. And she discovered that she was really extremely good and extremely fearless.
After the war, Violette decided to give up her husband. She and Cyprien eventually divorced, but not her pants. The trousers from her Red Cross uniform became a staple. This was a bold move in France, where laws dating back to the Napoleonic era prohibited women from wearing pants. But for the time being, nobody stopped the woman with the 14-inch biceps, and Violette continued to excel in sports. At the 1921 and 22 Women's World Games, she won gold medals in the javelin and shot put. And after picking up a taste for speed during the war, she began racing cars.
She really was the first female all-round sportsperson that France had produced. So in the 20s, it really looked as if she was set for a glittering career. She excelled in a number of athletic disciplines.
And then everything started to go horribly wrong. Violette's rise coincided with the creation of a new organization, the
Fédération Française du Sport Féminin, the FFSF. And this federation was intended to promote the idea of sport as a healthy discipline, that sport would make young girls be better mothers, that sport would give them rosy cheeks and things like that, that it was just something that they should do while they were young. You know, if they played sport, they'd become healthy. And then, of course, they'd have lots of children.
You perhaps won't be shocked to learn that Violette and the FFSF didn't have much fraternité. Of course, there was the whole pants issue, but also...
she smoked furiously. She swore. I mean, her language was extraordinarily foul-mouthed.
There were also allegations that she gave amphetamines to younger players on her soccer team.
Now, all of this added together to make her exactly the opposite of what the FFSF had hoped when it was set up to produce delightful young ladies who just admired sport in an amateur way.
The FFSF put up with Violette for a while, but she really hurt her own cause when she punched a soccer referee. So in 1928...
they simply couldn't turn a blind eye to it. So they revoked Violette's license to be part of the French team.
Her auto racing license was also revoked, in part because of her pants. Violette protested, saying, "Look around and see what you see. See the women with their knees crossed and then ask yourself which is more immodest, their scanty dresses or my pants?" This argument was apparently lost on French officials. Violette's whole life had been tied to sports, and now it was being taken away. In 1930, she sued the FFSF, claiming damages. She could no longer earn money as an athlete. Here's what Violette said during the trial.
"We live in a country rotten by money and scandals, governed by Frasers, scoundrels and troublemakers. This country of small people is not worthy of its elders, not worthy to survive. One day its decadence will lead him to the rank of a slave, but I, if I am still there, I will not be one of the slaves. Believe me, that's not in my temperament."
The court upheld the FFSF's right to ban Violette, and Violette remained furious with her home country. And this brings us back to Hitler and that invitation to the 36 Olympics.
She's easy prey to switch her loyalties to the Germans, or more specifically, we should say, to the Nazis.
Nazi officials believed they could turn Violette Morris into a spy. And they were right. She had plenty going for her. She had operated a car parts business, so she had access to a vehicle and fuel. Plus, she still knew people throughout France from her sports career. And Violette's days driving ambulances near the front lines had taught her quite a bit.
She could report on what the French were doing. She understood the tank formations. She knew what the Germans needed to know.
Plus, Seba says, her size was intimidating.
And I think that was another aspect of her use to the Germans.
So Violette returned to France after the games and continued to correspond with the Nazis. She drove around the country, likely gathering information on the locations of French troops in the Maginot Line, the fortifications on France's northeastern border. After the Nazi invasion, Violette remained close to the Germans, though there's some debate over her exact role. One French biography paints a grisly picture.
There is very definitely an accusation that she became a Nazi torturer. She had the nickname the hyena of the Gestapo because apparently she derived so much sadistic pleasure from torturing people and extracting information.
And Seba hasn't found any proof that Violette tortured. But she says Violette worked with the French Gestapo. She had access to black market goods and transported Nazi and Vichy officials. The fact that Violette was a collaborator wasn't much of a secret. And that became a problem for Violette as the war began to turn against the Nazis.
By 1944, it was clear to most people that the Nazis were losing the battle. I think Violette probably knew that at some point she would be called to pay the price for her work on the wrong side.
With the Allies gearing up for D-Day, there were orders from London to take out hundreds of Gestapo or would-be Gestapo agents before the invasion. Preserving the element of surprise was key. Violette Morris was on the list.
She had to be killed before the D-Day landings.
The Maquis, part of the French resistance, were carrying out many of the assassinations.
These ambushes were constant. They killed them however they could.
On April 26th, 1944, the Maquis spotted Violette driving through Normandy, and Seba presumed she was snooping around to see what she could see. Also in Violette's car, a family with two children. That didn't stop the Maquis from firing. Violette and everyone else in the vehicle were killed.
The fact that she dies in a hail of bullets is almost how one expects somebody like that to die.
There are still many details about the life of Violette Morris that are subject to debate. Anne Seba and other historians point out that those allegations of torturing may have been played up by the French to justify the killings of those innocent children in Normandy. On top of all that, Anne Seba is left wondering what Violette Morris's legacy could have been.
You know, she could have been remembered as a great female athlete, and I wonder if that's something that ever occurred to her, that she'd let that chance slip through her fingers.
That's historian and author Anne Seba speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You can read more about Violette Morris and other interesting characters in Seba's recent book, Les Parisiennes, How the Women of Paris Lived, Loved, and Died Under Nazi Occupation. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler, Gary Wallach, and me. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder, Paul Kahlo, and LaJean Lawson, who talked to me for a whole hour about the history of sports bras. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word comes from Lisa Lindahl, inventor of the modern sports bra.
I've heard every bra and breast joke in the book, so please, let's not go there.
Check. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.